The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for the last few weeks, I've been talking about reactivity, different ways to explore reactivity. The first week, I talked about kind of how reactivity is created in our minds. That it's kind of a simple process for something that winds us up so much. But basically, there's something either pleasant or unpleasant that happens to us. And then we either like it, we don't like it. We want to hold on to it if it's pleasant, get more of it, keep it. Get fearful that it's going to go away. Or if it's unpleasant, we want to get rid of it, push it away. We hate it. We're frustrated that it's here. So the basic structure of reactivity, what I talked about the first week, is kind of born out of this reaction to whether things are pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Now, the neutral kind of reactivity is something we might not really be so cognizant of. The pleasant and unpleasant, we kind of more can be more aware of in some way. That we're aware that we like things and want them. We're aware that we don't like things and want to get rid of them. We may not be consciously aware of the pleasant or unpleasant aspect of experience, but we know it's there. Whereas neutral experience, sometimes it just kind of goes right past us. But when an experience is kind of neutral, we may react with boredom or confusion, something along those lines. So in general, the reactive emotions come, the structure of the reactive emotions come because we are reacting to things being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral in some form. And in that first week, I talked a little bit about how if we can begin to see what we're actually reacting to, because often we think, for instance, that we're reacting to you're having a conversation with somebody and they say something that triggers you. The kind of way that unfolds with respect to this pleasant or unpleasant reactivity is that they say something and it forms an idea in your mind. Maybe it's an idea in your mind, something like, that person isn't listening to me. And that creates a whole kind of concept in the mind, which from the perspective of self is an unpleasant concept. So we react to, it perhaps generates some feelings of not being seen, some feelings that perhaps go back to childhood of being dismissed or ignored. And those feelings don't feel good. So there's an unpleasant feeling. And what we're actually responding to or reacting to are those feelings that have been created kind of in this process. So we tend to not like unpleasant experience. We tend to want to get rid of it and push it away. We tend to like pleasant experience. We tend to want to hold on to it and keep it. And so this a couple weeks ago when I talked about this, I was pointing to beginning to recognize what it is you're actually reacting to. What is it? If you're experiencing some kind of aversion, there's probably something unpleasant in your environment or in your mind, an idea that's unpleasant in your mind that you're reacting to. If you're reacting by wanting to hold on to something or keep something, or one of the pleasant experiences I've been noticing a lot lately is the feeling of being in control of my world. That when I feel like I can maneuver my world, there's a pleasant experience that comes along with that. And if I'm not aware of that, I can respond and react to that feeling of control, especially when I no longer have control of the environment or of what's going on. That thwarting of control brings up that sense of tightness, contraction. So when we can actually recognize what is pleasant, what is unpleasant in our experience, it can begin to short-circuit the leap of the mind onto reactivity. So that's like the, you know, few-minute summary of what I talked about the first week. Then last week I talked about exploring the reactivity itself, how we can use our mindfulness practice to actually turn towards all of these challenging emotions. We typically, with these difficult emotions, are experiencing some kind of struggle or suffering or distress in the very experience of those emotions. When anger is present, I think I said this last week, but it was kind of a surprise to me when I finally recognized that when anger was present in my own heart, that it was not a pleasant place to be. It was kind of shocking to me that I had spent, anger was kind of a typical way for me to navigate the world. And I was, you know, cognizant that it had an impact on other people. In fact, I wanted them to be miserable when I was angry. But I was not aware that I was actually miserable. And so when we turn with mindfulness towards our reactive emotions, our afflictive emotions, we begin to see this is not heading towards well-being. And the mind, in the willingness to meet that experience of reactivity, turning towards it in the experience in the body, recognizing how it impacts the mind, what are the emotions that it produces, the willingness to meet our reactivity with a kind attention, a non-reactive attention, kind of opening our heart to recognize, yes, this reactivity is happening. And if we look at our history, often we've practiced these kinds of reactions a lot in our lives. We've conditioned these kinds of reactions a lot in our lives. And sometimes I can recognize, of course anger is arising. Look how much I've practiced it. You know, of course, look at the conditions. Of course frustration is arising. The conditions have led to this so many times in the past that this is a well-worn groove in the mind. And so if we can recognize in some ways that we can't simply, in recognizing our reactivity, say, be gone, stop, end. It doesn't work that way. But the mindfulness, the willingness to be connect with this friendly attention or kind attention to our reactivity allows, I think of it as disengaging the gears. It allows us to notice that reactivity, but no longer be fueling it or feeding it in the same way. Often, when reactivity is present, there's a lot of thinking going on, and that those thoughts tend to re-cement the reactivity. He shouldn't have done that. She shouldn't have done that. I should make sure they know they should never do that again. We cycle in our minds over and over again, and that those thoughts tend to reinforce the reaction. And so if we are instead paying attention to the experience of reactivity itself instead of being engaged in the story, that's like disengaging the gears. And what happens when you disengage the gears on your car, for instance, if you're going 100 miles an hour, let's say 60 miles an hour down the freeway, if you're going 60 miles an hour down the freeway and you disengage the gears, you put the car in neutral, it doesn't come to a stop right away. But it will come to a stop because it's no longer got the gas going. And similarly, when we bring that non-reactive mindfulness to our experience, it's like putting our mind in neutral. It allows the reaction to unwind itself and come to a stop kind of naturally. So I explored that aspect of reactivity last week, what it means to turn towards our reactions, meet them. Meet them with a friendly attention. When we're willing to do that, we're willing to turn towards and meet our reactions. Sometimes we see something kind of surprising. I think often our reactivity to things is born, it's born, you know, the kind of the way I talked about it being born out of unpleasant, or neutral. But it's also connected to the fact that, you know, like when things are pleasant, we like them and we want them. That's connected to a deep underlying wish, that movement towards having what we want, getting what we want, getting rid of what we don't want, is connected towards a deep underlying wish to be well and happy. We like to be happy. We want to be happy. In a very deep way, the movement of our organism is towards happiness and well-being. It wants to be at ease, peaceful, happy. That's the direction our organism would like to go. And yet, it's kind of fundamentally misunderstood how to get there. It thinks, our organism thinks that having what I want will make me happy. And indeed, it does, for a very short time, make us happy to get something that we want. To have that sense of being in control, as I pointed to. Now, that feeling of, yeah, I'm in control, that feels really good for a short time while I can manage the conditions for that particular time. So it feels good to get what we want. It feels good to get rid of what we don't want. It feels good to have the sense of being in control. And yet, in a way that, well, we could call the habit of how we move towards happiness is very short-sighted. You know, it's like we're willing to just be on this hamster wheel of get what we want, have a feeling of happiness, and then it's like, well, that happiness was great. Let me find another one. So get the next thing that I want. Get rid of the next thing so that I don't have that in my environment. Get the next thing. Get rid of the next thing. Get the next thing. Get rid of the next thing. Over and over again, we've tied our happiness to constructing conditions, to getting what we want, getting rid of what we don't want, to feeling like we're in control. We've tied our happiness to that. And it's an endless project. It's a never-ending, exhausting project. Rainer Maria Rilke had a way of putting this. He said, "And we, spectators, always, everywhere turn toward the world of objects. It fills us. We arrange it. It breaks down. We rearrange it, then break down ourselves." That's kind of the story of our lives, a continual rearrangement. And the feeling of frustration, of failure, of why me, when we discover we can't always arrange things the way we'd like them to be. So we are motivated at a deep level by this wish for happiness. And yet this project that we're engaged in terms of finding happiness, it's like we've gone around about it the wrong way. We're going about it kind of a funny way. And so this, you know, but it's interesting to recognize that deep underlying our sense of perhaps fear or anxiety or sense of vulnerability is a sense that a wish for safety, a wish for ease in our lives, a wish for happiness. So kind of deep underlying our reactions is this motivation towards happiness. And this actual motivation is a wholesome, beautiful motivation. It's connected with the quality of metta, of loving kindness. In fact, the expression of metta, there are practices of metta to cultivate that quality, to practice inclining the mind towards that quality. And some of the phrases that we use are, may I be happy, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be safe, may you live with ease. This expression of the wish for well-being, the wish for happiness, the wish for safety, the wish for ease in one's life is a wholesome wish. It's a beautiful wish for ourselves. It's a beautiful wish for ourselves. It's a beautiful wish for others. And so that wish, that deep wish for happiness, actually kind of underlies a lot of our reactivity, because we get confused about how we might find our way to true happiness. And the Buddha actually encouraged us to look at letting go of that project of trying to rearrange things, and that in that exploration we might discover that the letting go of wanting things to be different, the letting go of the desire to hold on to pleasant things, the letting go of the wish to get rid of unpleasant things, that in that very wish to have things be otherwise, that is where the unhappiness is born. And that if that wish, that desire for things to be otherwise can be released, there's no problem. So it's interesting sometimes in our exploration of reactivity and looking at reactivity to see if we can perhaps touch into or maybe explore a little bit about what is the deeper wish. Perhaps recognizing or connecting to that deeper wish for safety or happiness or well-being. It's not always immediately obvious. And for me, the way this has been revealed is through the willingness to meet, to just meet that reactivity with mindfulness. Not judging it, not trying to get rid of it. An example, depression, a feeling of depression, just hanging out with this feeling of depression. It was pretty persistent. This was on a long retreat, and it was a good couple weeks, 2-3 weeks, that I was feeling this kind of persistent, low-grade depression. And it would come and go, but it was a pretty frequent visitor. And so I, you know, just started observing it, really just opening, it's like, okay, you know, it's fine for this depression to be here. And I noticed a lot. I learned a lot about how my mind got caught, what kinds of things it reacted to. One of the surprises for me was that actually that depression often started from a place of calm. That was kind of a surprise. And that there's just a sense of ease and relaxation, and then, whew, I would kind of slip into this depression. It's kind of surprising to me. It also seemed to be connected with seeing other people. This was I was at a monastery where there were talking was allowed, and there seemed to be an part of a time in the evening where people would pair up, and there would be this promenade, you know, kind of like people would get into pairs and do this little walk and talk thing. And I noticed that it would come up when I was seeing people pair up and I wasn't paired up. It's like, oh yeah, that's like high school. It's like not being chosen at the dance or something. And so there was that sense too that it was related or somehow connected with other people somehow. But I was just watching it, willing to watch it be present, willing to watch it be not present. And that actually is a really helpful tool in looking at a persistent reactivity. When something seems like it's there a lot, it's kind of in the field over a period of time, notice when it's actually not there, because it's not always there. And that begins to kind of poke holes in the belief that it's a solid, continuous thing, to recognize, oh, actually, it's not there right now. So I was doing a lot of this, doing a lot of this exploration. And at one point, the feeling, I got into the touch with the bodily feeling of the depression. And at one point, I was doing lying meditation, and I was feeling the feeling of that, kind of there was a contracted feeling in the heart, a tightness, a squeezing around the heart. And I was just feeling that, and it got bigger, and it got bigger, and it just grew. It expanded. It felt like it expanded beyond the edges of my body, this feeling of depression. But it was just like, it was okay. It was like, oh, it's okay. And then at some point, the experience just like turned inside out, and the experience became an expansive feeling of love. That was not what I expected to find underneath that feeling of depression. And in that very moment, that moment of seeing it, it was like this beautiful state of the feeling of depression had grown big, and when it flipped inside out, the feeling of love was pretty big. It was a nice, lovely, expansive feeling of love. And the next thought in my mind that arose was, this is stupid, this is sappy, this is corny. And I saw that I had a kind of a, I had a relationship to that kind of love that I thought somehow it wasn't such a good thing. So that also showed me something. Again, it was kind of like that underneath that feeling of depression was some kind of a subtle repression of the open heart. A subtle sense of it's not okay to have an open heart. Many, many times in my exploration of difficulty of reactive emotions, this is just one example, many times I've seen something really beautiful underneath. Underneath fear, the sense of the wish for safety, not only for myself, but for all beings everywhere. The wish that all beings be safe and protected from danger. Underneath that feeling of fear, when I could connect with that feeling of that wish for safety, the fear was released, and then it would come back, and then it would release, and then it would come back. So this exploration of our reactivity can actually guide us into some very beautiful states of mind. It can help us to uncover or touch into these beautiful wishes for love, for compassion. So one thing that I've seen or understood, I guess, for myself in exploring reactivity with mindfulness, initially I very much had this notion that what needed to happen was that entire pattern of reactivity I needed to get a scalpel and like cut out all around it and like remove the tumor. You know, that was kind of my idea, that the whole thing was bad. And what I've seen over and over again is that deep in the middle of that reactivity often is something that's really beautiful. And that, I think, is partly why these reactions have such a hold on us. It's like we if we are approaching our awareness of anger, for instance, with the idea, I need to get rid of this anger, that anger may be serving some kind of a protection. You know, there could be inside a sense of wish for safety and security. And that wish is a wholesome wish. And it's not going to go quietly. You know, just it's not going to put up with being dismissed. And yet there is a way to touch back into that wholesome wish and not have the kind of convoluted relationship on top of it. I'm explaining myself here to touch into that. So another way, kind of another avenue for exploring softening our minds is to kind of use the understanding that these beautiful qualities of mind are our kind of deepest orientation, the wish for safety, the wish for being free from suffering, and to cultivate those qualities. And the Buddha sometimes talked about the cultivation of these beautiful qualities of mind as being kind of an antidote to some of these reactive patterns of mind. So I'm just going to say a few words about these qualities, to just speak about them a little bit and kind of evoke them, I hope, give you a sense of what they are and how they are open-hearted. You know, when we talk about like the wish for happiness, the wish for well-being, the wish for safety, sometimes that wish can come with the feeling of contraction just right away. You know, it's like, oh, may I be safe? Oh, immediately there could be a sense of, but I'm not safe. And so there's the contraction. But to just, to perhaps evoke a little bit of the sense of this open-hearted possibility for these wishes, that these wishes can exist in the context of not contracting. So the quality of metta, quality of loving kindness, is essentially the quality of connection, of the open heart, of friendliness, of caring. It can be a very simple feeling. It doesn't have to be, I mean, it doesn't have to either be like Hallmark greeting card kind of love, which is, I think, where my mind went with that sappy business. And it doesn't also have to, it doesn't have to be, you know, boundless. It can just be a very simple quality of caring, connection, friendliness. It's the kind of feeling that you might have upon seeing a dear friend when you hadn't seen them for a very long time. Just imagine that. how that might feel. That's that quality of metta. You know, you just wish them well. No particular, perhaps, demands on them. Just the joy of seeing their face again. Just the simplicity of that. That's the kind of quality of metta, of loving kindness. It doesn't need anything in return. It doesn't have to get anything. And in fact, when we can touch into this quality, you know, this sense of just open-hearted connection kind of is related to a sense of being present for ourselves and for other people. At least I've seen that in my own experience, that when I'm really able to be present for somebody, especially when they're struggling, really able to be present, there's a sense of that connection, and people can feel that. People can feel when you're really with them. And they feel it as kindness, as caring. And we can do that for ourselves as well. It doesn't have a demand to it. It's just the wish for well-being, the wish for happiness. That quality of friendliness, connection, open-heartedness has some different flavors to it depending on what's happening in our world. So when that open heart, the heart that is not contracted, the heart that is kind of soft, non-resistant, when that heart meets someone who's struggling or suffering, the response of that heart is compassion. That's the flavor that metta turns towards, that quality of loving kindness turns towards when there is suffering that heart meets. So that might happen in talking to a friend, it might happen in reading the newspaper, it might happen in watching the news, seeing just how much suffering there is in this world. Our hearts often do contract around that. And part of our exploration is to recognize, again, not to try, that contraction in a sense is the, you know, it's the reactivity around that wish. No, it's the wish that suffering not be there. You know, so the heart that is open to suffering feels that suffering quite deeply. And sometimes the response is it closes down because it's like, it shouldn't be that way. So the compassionate heart is able to acknowledge the suffering. It's like this, and not close down around it. That's a gift, actually, to the world, to be able to be witness to suffering. It also comes with the wish to take some action to alleviate that suffering. So it's not simply the feeling of being able to be with the suffering. It comes with the wish to alleviate that suffering, but it also acknowledges and understands, it has the wisdom in a way to recognize when it can take action and do something and when it can't. It also has the wisdom to recognize when that action is coming out of my own difficulty in being with the suffering. So one kind of example around this that I think is a powerful way that we can bring our open heart to our friends is when they are suffering. You know, often we go into fix-it mode, right? You know, we often like want to give them advice and help them figure out what to fix or to change. And think about how you feel when somebody is giving you advice. You know, probably you've thought of that advice yourself. I mean, occasionally somebody can come up with something that's helpful, but much of the time, don't you just want to be heard? Don't you just want to have somebody to witness your suffering? And when we can do that for another person, again, they feel that. They can feel that as love. To not have to fix somebody or change somebody. Often that wanting to give somebody advice is coming because we're so uncomfortable with the feeling of suffering itself. We're not able to just rest with that feeling and be open-hearted to that feeling. So compassion comes with the wish to take action, but it's also wise about how it does that. Another flavor of this metta, of this friendly heart, the open heart, is when there's joy, when there's something beautiful or wonderful happening. A friend comes with wonderful news. Sometimes we're happy for them, and there's a little bit of, well, why not me? Why aren't I that happy? A little bit of jealousy or envy or something can crop up. Again, the open heart is able to meet with, resonate with. It's like resonating with the joy of others. It's a beautiful emotion. It's called mudita in the Pali. Sympathetic joy is a good translation for it, I think. And it does, I like that term, sympathetic joy, because for me it evokes the term sympathetic vibration in music, where there's two strings close to each other and you pluck one string and the other vibrates in resonance to that first string, so it creates some overtones. That's a sympathetic vibration of the string in music. And it's like when an open heart, this heart that's not contracted, meets joy, it like resonates with joy. Again, there's the challenge that we have around these things. So seeing, again, how reactivity can be born out of these, kind of a confused response to these beautiful emotions. For myself, when I first started the practice of, sympathetic joy or exploring, wishing somebody else happiness and, you know, imagining them being very happy, it's like, wait a minute, there's only so much happiness to go around. If I'm wanting that person to be happy, I'm wanting less for me. That was my belief. Again, kind of a stunning belief when I saw what was going on in my mind. Actually, the more we can have the open heart about happiness, the more opportunities we have for happiness. The Dalai Lama, this was probably some 15 years ago or something, based on the number, he said, it's good to take joy in the happiness of others, because then you increase your odds of happiness 6 billion to 1. So these qualities of the open heart, the Buddha talked about cultivating these qualities. Actually, you know, it's kind of like if we incline our hearts to recognize them when they happen, because they do happen. You know, this quality of the joy in the joy of others. If you see a little kid playing, you know, if you go to a playground and watch little toddlers learning how to walk, and they fall down and they pick themselves up, and they fall down and they pick themselves up, and they accomplish something new on the playground, like walking across sand, and they just have this joy in their face. It's like we can resonate to that. So we have these responses, these open-hearted responses. There are times when we feel these experiences of love, of compassion, of joy. So just beginning to recognize them when they happen. And mindfulness itself, cultivating the non-reactive attention, also supports the growth of these qualities. Actually, they all kind of come along for the ride together. As we bring our awareness with this intention towards not judging what's happening, it begins to turn the mind towards acceptance, open-heartedness, allowing what's here to be here. All of those are related to metta. So all of these practices, they all work together. And you can also consciously cultivate or incline the mind towards metta itself. I mean, not only cultivating it through the practices of mindfulness or noticing when it happens. You know, one of the great things about mindfulness is that it's got this amazing property. You know, it's like we've been talking about reactivity for the last few weeks and how mindfulness, turning our mindfulness towards reactivity, it puts in the mind into neutral. It allows the reactivity to run its course. So the non-judgmental mindfulness towards reactivity kind of creates the conditions for the reactivity to disappear. It creates the conditions for that reactivity to appear less and less in our lives, the more we're able to witness it with non-judgmental, open-hearted, friendly attention. And mindfulness has this other great property that when we actually recognize and connect with the beautiful qualities of heart, when we see joy, when we see love, when we see generosity, when we see compassion, when we recognize them arising, the mindfulness doesn't simply allow them to, it doesn't just create the condition, it doesn't create the conditions for them to disappear. It creates the conditions for them to appear more frequently in our hearts and minds. And my understanding of this is because our organisms are oriented towards well-being, oriented towards happiness, oriented towards peace and joy. And when we are aware of those qualities of heart, the mind recognizes, yes, this way does lie a truer happiness. And so the mindfulness both serves to help to let go of the difficulty and to cultivate the beautiful. And so bringing mindfulness supports the cultivation of these qualities of love, of kindness, of compassion, joy, when we notice them, when they happen. Just to kind of open to the possibility that they happen, and you may start to see them happening. And we can consciously cultivate these qualities, actually using intention and thought. It's like using a reflective practice to incline the mind towards actually thinking thoughts of friendliness. This is an interesting thing. You know, we don't necessarily trust this as a practice. You know, it's like if I'm feeling instructions the Buddha said, well, if you're having angry thoughts, one of the ways you can work with that is to replace it with friendly thoughts. And that maybe sounds kind of counterintuitive to us, or it sounds like, well, we're not being true to ourselves by replacing those thoughts. But this is actually something that the Buddha said was a possibility. Now, I think he was saying it's a possibility when you're not repressing anything. He's not suggesting to repress anything. But it is possible. I mean, it's like we can't think two thoughts at the same time. So if your thought's going, rah, 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 you know, they shouldn't have done that. They, rah, rah, rah. If you can replace those thoughts with, they're trying the best they can. They're having a bad day, and I hope that they can have some freedom from that struggle. If we can replace our thoughts with those kind of more friendly thoughts, and the basic friendly thoughts that these three qualities come with are, you know, may you be at ease, may you be happy, may you be safe, may you be healthy, may you be free from your struggles. And when there's joy, may your joy continue. So we can consciously incline our minds towards these emotions, not trying to construct them. The practice of these practices of metta, of compassion, of joy, cultivating them consciously in this way, isn't about trying to construct the quality. It's kind of like planting, it's like planting seeds of intention, that every time you express the wish, something like, may that person be free from their struggles. Even if you can't feel the sense of compassion there, just expressing that wish is expressing the intention towards compassion. And that expression of intention is pretty powerful, actually. Intention has a powerful role in our minds. Most of the time, our intentions are created based on our habits, how we've been raised, what we've been trained to do, what we've rehearsed over and over again. I had some pretty powerful intentions towards anger in my life. And when mindfulness is not present, our intentions are generally guided by our habits. When mindfulness is present, we may not be able to muster the underlying feeling, but we can incline the mind with the thought, with the intention of, may this incline the heart in this direction. May this wish incline the heart towards friendliness, kindness, caring. So this practice, there's kind of a formal practice around it. I'm not going to describe the formal practice. I don't really have time, but this practice of inclining the mind towards these beautiful qualities can begin to kind of create new grooves in our minds, rewire the brain a little bit. Many different ways to rewire the brain. Mindfulness is a great way to rewire the brain. And this way also of consciously inclining towards these qualities. Some of you may find this very congenial. Others of you may not. I know for me, in my first couple of years of my practice, this practice was not natural for me at all. It was the heart, every time, like when I would make these wishes, the heart would just contract out of fear, out of confusion, out of, as I said, you know, the sense of, there's not going to be enough happiness for me. So for me, it took quite a while before I could really go with this kind of practice. I could work with the mindfulness practice. You know, the mindfulness practice was pretty resonant for me. I could be with my anger and explore things from that direction. That began to soften my heart. And eventually I was able to actually wish happiness even for the people who had caused me very deep suffering. So we don't really have quite enough time for questions, but let's just have a couple of minutes at the end here to just touch into this quality a little bit of friendliness and caring, So closing your eyes and taking a couple of breaths to settle and connect with your body. And allowing your attention to kind of rest in the area of your heart. This is the seat, in a way, of our emotional life, the area of our heart. And just notice what you're feeling there. What's present? There may be some tightness or aching or openness or whatever's there is fine. Maybe there's not much of a sense of what's there. So maybe there feels a little bit of emptiness, or that's okay too. Allowing yourself to connect with a sense of yourself. And recollecting some qualities that you appreciate about yourself. And if your mind kind of runs up against a wall with that, I'll offer you some things. You're all here with the wish to understand your hearts and minds. And that's a very beautiful quality. So appreciate yourself for that. And wish yourself well. May I be happy, safe. Healthy and at ease. And may all beings everywhere also be happy, as I wish for happiness. So too may all beings be happy, as I wish for health. So too may all beings everywhere be healthy, have healthy food, healthy water. As I wish to be safe, so too may all beings everywhere be safe. As I wish to be at ease, so too may all beings everywhere be at ease. Thank you for your attention. And I will be leaving on Sunday to go spend 6 weeks at Insight Meditation Society to teach a 6-week retreat. So I'll be away for 6 weeks, and there'll be, for the next 4 weeks, Nikki Mirgafori is going to be here offering a 4-week series on some of the Buddha's instructions about mindfulness. So I hope some of you will appreciate that. And then I think the following week, Tanisaro Bhikkhu will be speaking on Thursday night. So this evening will continue, so even as I am away. So I hope that you will appreciate, have a good fall, and I hope to see many of you in about 7 weeks.